DW Deutsche Welle. World in Progress.
Today on the program, a controversial new law to restrict indigenous land rights in Argentina.
The land is our life. It needs to be cared for coming generations.
Rescuing Lake Chad and economic development versus villagers' right to self-determination in Myanmar.
3 years ago, it was impossible to demonstrate because of the regime. If we had demonstrated, they would have put us in prison.
Welcome to World in Progress. I'm Anke Raspa in Bonn. And our first story today takes us to Argentina, where the government is currently considering a change to the nation's civil code. Yet activists are worried that this change could severely limit the land rights of the country's indigenous people. The new code would exclude land rights for 450,000 indigenous who live in Argentina's cities, without taking into account all the land that has already been taken from the country's native peoples. The new law would also classify indigenous territories as private rather than communal lands, which contradicts the way the traditional owners see their land. From Buenos Aires, Alicia O'Neill has the details and Nina Hase voiced her report.
Carmen Burgos lives in Buenos Aires's Once neighborhood with her sister, niece and nephew. She's of the Coya people of northeastern Argentina, but she moved to Buenos Aires 13 years ago so she could get a college education.
Here, I was like a fish out of water. Everything was different. Sometimes they laughed at my accent, that I couldn't pronounce the double R. To this day, I can't pronounce it. And also, there was the stereotype that everyone from the north is quiet and shy. I said, wow, I'm finding out for the first time that I'm shy, that I'm quiet.
Burgos says she lives with her family because it's one way to be part of a community, even though she lives far from her first home.
It was one thing to be uprooted from my home. It was so hard for me to get used to the city and to be different here. So I never wanted to separate myself from my family.
Burgos's niece, Camila, is 7 years old. She knows only one song in Quechua, the language spoken by the Coya people, because she was born and raised in Buenos Aires, where she speaks Spanish all the time. In order to keep Camila connected to her relatives and to the Coya culture, her mother and aunt bring her to northern Argentina every year. There are more plants and animals there than here, Camila says. Do you like it better here or there? Carmen Burgos asks her niece. There, Camila answers. And do you feel more comfortable with the people there? Yes, Camila answers without hesitation. Carmen Burgos is one of 30,000 indigenous people in Argentina who've moved to a city from an indigenous community. Over half of those people migrated in search of work or educational opportunities.
Mi nombre es Roberto Aramayo. Soy de Salta. Pertenezco al pueblo de Aguita.
My name is Roberto Aramayo. I'm from Salta. I belong to the Diaguita people. I've been living in Buenos Aires for more than 30 years. I came here when I was 15 because there wasn't a high school in the community where I lived.
No había colegio secundario.
Mi nombre es Luis Lobo. Soy de la etnia Com.
My name is Luis Lobo. I'm of the Com people, from Chaco in Santa Fe. I've lived in Buenos Aires for many years, but one never gets used to the pace of living in a city. It's hard to live here.
Todos los indígenas urbanos no somos de la ciudad.
Urban indigenous people are not from the city. Our homeland is our territory. We're living here for a time, but we're also always supporting the demands of our relatives who live in the territory.
The proposed civil code revision states that Argentina's indigenous communities have the right to rural land in order to preserve their culture and homeland. By doing so, it excludes all of the country's urban indigenous people, even though three times as many indigenous people live in Argentina's cities as in the countryside.
The fact that we live in cities doesn't mean that we aren't asking for land, but that our land is where our grandfathers and grandmothers lived.
The proposed civil code revision also doesn't mention all of the land that has already been taken from indigenous people. And it classifies indigenous territory as private rather than communal property, says Roberto Aramayo of the Diaguita.
Including us in the civil code would mean treating our territories like just land, which can be bought and sold, which has a property deed. And our claim is much bigger than that because it's more transcendent. The land is our life. We are part of the land, so it cannot be bought or sold. It's not transferable. It needs to be cared for coming generations.
Lawyer Silvina Ramirez is the president of the Argentine Association of Lawyers for Indigenous Rights. She says, regardless of its content, the new civil code is illegitimate because while drafting it, the government ignored the indigenous people's constitutional right to be consulted.
The indigenous people should be consulted about a special law that only deals with the issue of indigenous land rights. It's unrealistic to think that the government's not going to pass the civil code revision so they can consult indigenous people when it's been a permanent state policy to ignore indigenous people. Now the government's pretending to be inclusive, but really they're completely forgetting about the indigenous people and about the status they have in the constitution.
3 to 5% of Argentina's population is indigenous. They're scattered across the country, and they belong to as many as 20 different ethnic groups, so it's hard for them to organize to defend their rights. There are also cultural differences between indigenous groups and the Western-style government, which makes communication even more difficult. Furthermore, the struggle for land often pits them against multinational companies with the resources and time for court battles, says Roberto Aramayo.
The state is always allied with big economic interests, whether those are mining, oil, forests, or simply fresh water. These riches are in our territories, so the state is the most interested party in not recognizing or in reducing our rights.
Aramayo named multinational mining companies such as Barrick Gold and multinational agricultural companies such as Monsanto as among those allied with the Argentine government. When indigenous rights activists can't find a friendly ear in their own government, they often make recourse to international organisms, says indigenous rights activist Nilo Cayuqueo of the Mapuche people of southern Argentina.
We're not asking for anything special. We're only asking for that which belongs to us as a people. We've been dispossessed of our lands and we want them back.
In May, Cayuqueo and other leaders plan to present the issue of the Argentine Civil Code at the United Nations Permanent Forum for Indigenous Peoples. Meanwhile, legislators plan to continue discussing the Civil Code throughout April, while indigenous rights activists protest their inclusion in the new code.
Land rights are also an issue in our next report, which comes from Myanmar in Southeast Asia. In mid-March, Burmese Nobel laureate Aung San Suu Kyi issued a report that caused anger and outrage in a small village in the northeast of the country. She backed the expansion of a copper mine, which villagers say was built on illegally seized land. They also claim that the mine, jointly run by a Chinese venture and a company owned by the Burmese military, has led to a rise in disease and pollution. While Myanmar inches towards democracy, the military is keeping a firm hold on its resources. Naomi Conrad reports.
In the distance, two bulldozers are chewing their way across the ridge, methodically clawing huge shovel loads of reddish-brown earth from the ground in their search for copper. The valley below is strewn with discarded piles of earth. There's reddish dust everywhere. The dust has crept into the folds of Sumi U's dirty grey T-shirt and stuck itself to his worn flip-flops. It's covered his tiny hut, huddled beside a lopsided pile of sand. The dust is even floating in a small pond. Some 20 aluminium cans are rusting in the murky, reddish-brown water, slowly accumulating the copper that Sumi U sells on to a Chinese middleman every week to buy rice for his family.
I'm worried. I'm afraid my children might get sick.
The copper is slowly creeping into his children's bones, making them brittle, the 22-year-old says softly. He gestures to his three children, crouching by the side of the pond. His daughter peers through her older brother's legs, clutching at his frayed trousers, then quickly pulls back. The copper is also poisoning the community's rivers, Sumi U says. They used to be able to sleep without mosquito nets, but now the dirty rivers are attracting mosquitoes and disease.
We don't hate the Chinese, at least as long as we have enough to eat. But if there is no longer enough, we will hate them.
The bulldozers trundling along the ridge above are Chinese. They dug up the fields where Sumi U's father used to grow tomatoes, peanuts and chilies, leaving behind dust and sand. Like many major mining and infrastructure projects, the copper mine in Monyo in the northeast of the country is jointly operated by Chinese investors and the Myanmar Economic Holdings, a company run by the Burmese army. When the West imposed sanctions against the military dictatorship in the mid-1990s, European and US companies were forced to leave Myanmar. Chinese contractors stepped in, happy to exploit the country's jade and copper mines, chop down its teak forests and build its roads and harbours. China didn't share the West's concerns that under the dictatorship critical journalists disappeared and that students who dared to demonstrate were tortured. Farmers like Wu Sein Tong knew to keep their mouths shut when their lands were confiscated for the copper mine in Monyuan.
3 years ago, it was impossible to demonstrate because of the regime. If we had demonstrated, they would have put us in prison.
Wu Sein Tong leans forward emphatically and angrily taps his green light against the bamboo mat he's sitting on. His green cheroot lies forgotten in a small ashtray. At first sight, there's nothing remarkable about Wu Sein Tong's village. There's a tea house with rickety plastic chairs, a small shop and a handful of boys zooming along the main road on rusty motorbikes. But the village is only a few kilometres from the copper mine with all its reddish dust and sand. And today, the villagers are no longer willing to keep quiet. Every couple of weeks, they gather in the main square and make their way down to the mine to demand full compensation for their land. Myanmar's military regime is inching towards democracy. But villagers say that last November there was a brutal crackdown on demonstrators in Monyua. The military regime, it seems, is determined to protect its economic interests. There's little the opposition can do, says U Ong Kiang.
We have to try to persuade them.
Persuade the military's echelons to give up their economic holdings, that is. U Ong Kiang fingers the small red badge stuck on his shirt that marks him out as a member of the National League for Democracy, the NLD. He spent 16 years in jail for being a founding member of the opposition party that was long outlawed by the military. U Ong Kiang's office in the former capital, Yangon, is uncomfortably hot and sticky. There's been another power cut. On the wall, there's a huge post of Aung San Suu Kyi, the NLD's leader, shaking President Obama's hand. A recent report on the copper mine compiled and presented by Aung San Suu Kyi said the mine should be allowed to continue operating to encourage foreign investors to help the lagging economy. The villagers were outraged. But U Ong Kiang, too, hopes that the West will help Myanmar.
In the parliament, we adopted the Foreign Investment Development Law. We give many openings for the investments for Western countries and our democratic states like German, European and American. But so far, they didn't come yet. They'll wait and see.
Ask Win Myo Tu about such hopes and Myanmar's leading environmentalist shrugs them off as naive. He is convinced that European or American companies are just as likely to pollute rivers, as long as there is no legal framework to prevent them.
There are so many cronies and rich people, the member of parliament, and they are in this ruling party, you know, USDP. And they are strongly against that because, you know, if environmental law is, you know, really promulgated and enforced, their business will be affected.
The government recently passed an environmental law, but Winmyo Tu says it is a mere farce. Less than 1% of the budget is allocated to the environment. He is afraid that China will hold on to Myanmar at all costs.
Every developing countries are very smart, you know, except for Obama. So once they know that there's a path to go, then everybody will try clean energy and clean product. Then they will find a country dumping ground to, you know, to sell their all dirty product and these unclean technology, you know, while they are moving forward, right? So Myanmar is perfect place for dumping ground because we are located within China, India, and Thailand. They will sell all their obsolete, these stupid technology and product.
Myanmar, says environmentalist Winmyo U, desperately needs to build up an environmental immune system. Strong laws that are enforced, if needs be, against entrenched military interests. For DW, this is Naomi Conrad in Yangon.
Still to come here on World in Progress, a report about the impact of the shrinking of Lake Chad in Central Africa. But first, here's Connor Dillon with some other developments from around the world.
Amnesty International criticizes Sudan for bombing Southern Province. Sudan's indiscriminate bordering of the rebellious South Kordofan province is stoking a developing crisis by displacing thousands and disrupting the planting of crops, Amnesty International said Tuesday. The human rights group said the situation was likely to get worse as food supplies dwindle and the rainy season cuts off roads, making relief missions impossible. The rights group urged the UN Security Council and African Union to take immediate steps that will force Sudan to halt the attacks. Debate on Guantanamo prison continues. In the U.S., public debate continued this week over the military prison at Guantanamo Bay after the New York Times published a highly charged article written by one of the inmates. Samir Naji Al-Hassan Mokbo is one of 43 prisoners at the U.S. military camp currently on hunger strike over detainees' quote, indefinite detention. The head U.N. official in charge of human rights, Navi Pillay, said last week that the indefinite detention of Guantanamo Bay inmates runs contrary to international law. She also called for the prison to be closed. The article also adds to criticism of President Obama for failing to follow through on a pledge to close Guantanamo during the first year of his presidency in 2009. Brazilian Indigenous Protest Amendment. On Wednesday, about 700 Brazilian Indians occupied a part of the lower house of Congress to protest a proposed amendment that would give Congress a say in the demarcation of indigenous territory. Protesters say that the reform package will benefit farmers while threatening their way of life.
That was Connor Dillon with the development news. Almost a billion people around the world face hunger and malnutrition, and that's partly due to the increased volatility of food prices. Price hikes hit the poorest hardest, and many say that increasing speculation on food staples in the past few years is one factor contributing to the ups and downs. Critics argue it's unethical to gamble on food, and bankers and funds earning money by speculating on foodstuffs have been discredited as hunger makers. While speculation on foodstuffs is relatively new to Europe, it's become big business in the USA. Janos Stecker went to find out more on Wall Street in New York. His report is presented by Sarah Steffen.
The building that houses the New York Mercantile Exchange, or NYMEX, resembles a fortress on the southern tip of Manhattan. On the trading floor behind the unimpressive beige-colored facade, dealers trade with cotton and crude oil and with foodstuffs like coffee, cocoa and sugar. But these are difficult times for NYMEX. Speculating with foodstuffs has fallen into disrepute over the last years. Gambling with commodities is unethical, critics say. However, the tradition of making business with foodstuffs goes back a long time.
Really goes back to Roman times. The earliest open-air markets were the ones that the Greeks and the Romans had, and the model that they had really created the basis for what became the agricultural commodities market as we know it today.
That's New York-based author Kara Newman. She published a book called The Secret Financial Life of Food in 2012. Such speculation initially provided a sort of stability to food prices, Newman says.
And that's really one of the most important aspects of the agricultural commodities market, is that it provides the producers a way to hedge their product and really guarantee against future disasters or surpluses that would otherwise create an economic hardship.
If, for instance, a farmer wants to sell potatoes to a French fries producer, producers and clients sign so-called futures contracts, which oblige both parties to deliver or buy a certain amount of commodities at a specified date in the future. The potato farmer, for instance, would agree to sell 10 sacks of potatoes within half a year for an agreed price. However, neither the producer nor the clients can foresee whether droughts will destroy the harvest, increasing prices. And this is where speculators come in to take on the liability for price volatility. Naturally, they hope to make profits. For a long time, foodstuff markets were considered stable. But over the past 5 years, commodity prices skyrocketed at first and then took a drastic hit. Observers speak of commodity bubbles. The headquarters of the non-governmental organization Why Hunger is situated in Manhattan. Their activists started noticing unusual price fluctuations on the foodstuffs market in 2008, campaigner Sienna Chrisman says.
We started really looking at some of what else had been happening and started working with some of our kind of more think tank partners who were saying, well, there was this deregulation of the commodities markets and there's been this huge speculation, and that's really the thing that's not being talked about.
Critics often talk about deregulation. In the past, commodities and foodstuffs in the U.S. were solely traded on the two big futures exchanges in New York and Chicago. But many of the old rules have since been suspended. Observers say that development started in 1991, when the industry began advocating commodities assets by introducing commodity indices. Gradually, the market was opened to private investors. George Giro, trader with asset manager RBC, explains.
We became blessed with what we call ETFs, exchange-traded funds, which were securities that invested in underlying commodities. And so people who could not trade futures contracts could now buy ETFs or exchange-traded funds.
In principle, ETFs trade with raw materials in much the same way as you trade stocks of bonds. The first raw material ETF was introduced in 2004, and the number of funds has since risen to hundreds. Among the most important investors in raw material markets today are big players like pension funds. They heard the alarm bells ring when the global economic crisis started in 2007 and consequently tried to find ways to reduce the risks from stock and bond markets. They started investing in raw materials, where the markets at the time were considered relatively stable. But even the raw materials markets, which used to be fairly manageable in the past, have now become more volatile. And critics like Sienna Chrisman from Why Hunger say that large pension funds investments have had an impact on the volatility of food prices.
There have been a lot of studies, economists from MIT and the World Bank and the IMF, as well as the UN, have made a real connection between commodity speculation and the food price crisis.
But not everybody agrees. In December of last year, 40 German professors wrote an open letter in which they stated that science has yet failed to prove the connection between speculation and price fluctuations on the foodstuffs market. But there's one thing everybody agrees on. Many of the investors on the foodstuffs market today pursue interests that have little to do with the original function of speculators.
Increased droughts and changing weather patterns have a very direct and detrimental impact on food crops. In Central Africa, the rapid shrinking of Lake Chad over the past few years has put the lives of 30 million people on the line. The lake used to be Africa's largest body of water, but now only 10% of its original quantity remains. Experts say the lake could disappear altogether by 2025 if nothing is done to save it. Ngala Kilian Chimtom reports from Yaoundé.
Approaching Lake Chad from Golfe, a small area in Cameroon's far north region, the air is dry and dusty, and the winds are fierce. Vegetation here is sparse, without trees, and scorched shrubs break the sandy expanse every few hundred meters. Bordered by Chad, Cameroon, Niger, and Nigeria, Lake Chad once spanned some 25,000 square kilometers, but in the last half century, it has shrunk by 90%. As a result of minimal rainfall, the two main rivers flowing into the lake are unable to feed it like years gone by. For generations, herders, fisherfolk, and farmers have relied on the basin's rich soils and water supply for their crops and stock and an ample amount of fish. Now the lake is drying up before them. On the banks of the lake, Muhammad Abubakar is disentangling a tiny black catfish from a large net. He says things have changed dramatically in the past few years.
You know, before you needed to cast the net just a few times to get thousands of fish, but today it may require a whole day work to get this.
Fisherfolk are paid about $2 for such a haul. This will be Muhammad Abubakar's only income for the day. Back when the lake was healthy and teeming with life, the 64-year-old fisherman could earn as much as $50 a day. But as the lake's water levels continue to drop, Muhammad expects the number of fish he will be able to catch to drop even further in future.
Survival has become a real problem here because we don't have any other means of livelihood.
Sanusi Irman Abdullahi is the executive director of the Lake Chad Basin Commission, a regional body created by the countries bordering the lake. He says the shrinking of the lake is taking a toll on local residents. But it is impossible to blame the crisis on one single factor, experts say. Environmentalist Augustine Jamshi, the Central African representative from the Pan-African Climate Alliance, blames both human activity and climate change for the decrease in water at the lake.
It has to do with the agricultural practices there, the way people are using the water. But I think climate change is also to be blamed for the disappearance of Lake Chad.
He explains that water from Cameroon's Shari River, which provides over 90% of the Lake Chad's water, is being diverted to irrigation projects in the surrounding area. Sanusi adds that population pressure is also stretching the lake to breaking point.
40 years ago, the population within the Lake Chad area was about 17 million. Now we have about 30 million plus. So you can see there is demand by the human population, increase in animal consumption, of course, and then massive evaporation as a result of climate change.
For the time being, farmers and fisher folk are showing resilience, adapting as best they can to the situation. Amadou Bello, a fisherman in Gulfey, couldn't make a living anymore when fish stocks in the lake dropped. So he turned his hand to farming, growing crops such as cowpea, maize, rice and peppers. Showing off his thriving farm, he says the disappearing lake has left behind very fertile land. But if the low rainfalls continue, the remaining water will evaporate, leaving locals with few options for a livelihood. In an effort to implement more sustainable solutions, the Commission has developed an ambitious plan to replenish the lake with water from the Obangi, a tributary of the Congo River. He says the project will involve the construction of a dam in Palambo, upstream of the capital of the Central African Republic, Bangui. The water will then be channeled to the Shari River in Cameroon through a 1,350-kilometer canal and then into Lake Chad.
There's so much water in the Congo that goes into the ocean. We are just going to take a fraction of it to save the lives of over 30 million people. So the program is not only to bring water to Lake Chad, but also to improve the economic activity and the livelihood of the people within the Congo Basin.
According to Abdullahi, the scheme will cost a staggering $14.5 billion. Experts say the cost of the project may look frightening, but the cost of inaction is even more devastating. He predicts the lake could disappear altogether by 2025 if nothing is done to save it. Ngala Kilian Chimtom, DW, Yaounde, Cameroon.
And this report wraps up today's edition of World in Progress. Thanks for tuning in. You can listen to these reports again and find more globalization stories on our webpage at dw.de/globalization. That's globalization with a Z. I hope you enjoyed the show and that you'll join me again next week at the same time. Until then, on behalf of today's studio team, Eliane Giaducci and Gerd Georgi, I'm Anke Rasper in Bonn saying thanks for listening and goodbye.